Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's David.
David.
I'm grateful to be sober and grateful to be here with y'all tonight. I thank Billy for inviting me to come share. I used to say I get nervous doing this, but what I think I really am is excited. I get excited to do this. I'm excited to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm excited to be part of this thing. So to get asked to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous is really kind of a thrill. I have a sobriety date. It's October 24th, 1989. I'm a member of a home group, Simple Actions meeting in Norfolk, Virginia. We're a big book open step study. We invite people to come in and share their experience, strength, and hope on a step week after week. Monday night, 7 o'clock. If I'm breathing in and out, that's where I'll be, in Norfolk, Virginia. I have a sponsor. My sponsor is aware that he's sponsoring me. I have a home group. I can look you in the eye and tell you I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm the outgoing secretary of that home group for another couple of days, and I'll be the incoming alt GSR. I take coffee commitments. I pick up cigarette butts. I'm the speaker getter for that group, so watch out. So I'm an active member of that group. I also have a position in the district. I help with the website. I have a position at the intergroup. I participate with the corrections committee, the treatment committee. I'm one of about six guys who gets to take a meeting to the eighth floor of the Norfolk City Jail on Thursday nights. I also have the privilege of working with other men, taking them through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tell you all that, not so you think I'm a great guy, but I tell you all that because I can look in the eye and tell you that I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't think it's a coincidence that I've never been busier in Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, and I've never been happier in my life. And I think those two things go hand in hand. I'm one of the people that kind of believes you're either heading in the direction of recovery or you're heading in the direction of a drink, and so I like to be an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me early on to say yes, and I started doing that, saying yes. You want to go to coffee, David? We know you don't. Just say yes. Come on, let's go. And so just kind of going along, and it took a little while to buy into that idea. So I'm to come and share my experience, strength, and hope. Well, the only thing I really have is my own story. I'd like to tell somebody else's sometime, but I've just got mine. So I grew up in an alcoholic home. I don't think that has any bearing on the fact that I became an alcoholic, but it's just a fact. I grew up watching people drink, and that all seemed normal and attractive to me. I sort of see myself as a freeze-dried alcoholic, you know. I just add liquid, and I'll be ready to go. You know, I really believe if I'd have been raised in cotton, and as soon as that drink hit me, something else was going to happen after that, you know, because it had an effect on me. I'll tell a story about my dad. Real quick, I think it's funny, but it gives you an idea. My dad led kind of a charmed life. He was a kind of guy, he was captain of the football team, married the head cheerleader. He went on a football scholarship to Wake Forest when Arnold Palmer was there, on a golf scholarship. He made a lot of money, he made a lot of friends. He ended up becoming a veterinarian. And he insisted on being called, are you recording?
Yes.
He insisted on being calling Doctor last name. He always introduced himself as Doctor. And even as a little kid, that used to embarrass me, you know. I used to think, come on, you're a dog doctor, you know, like lighten up on the title, Pop, you know. Didn't seem to bother me, you know, that the man had, you know, gotten an education, shown up where he was supposed to show up and achieved something. It kind of galled me that he was so proud of the doctor title. But anyway, he was, and this was 1965. I was about 4 years old, so what I'm about to tell you is hearsay. But my dad paid cash for a 1965 Malibu SS 396 candy apple red, white rag convertible top, four-speed, beautiful, classic, something you would see on a classic muscle car magazine today. Paid cash for it, drove it off the showroom floor, had it about 3 weeks, and lost control of it on the Serpentine Road on the way to our house, and he went up the went off the road, up the guy wire, into the telephone pole, snapped the telephone pole, knocked the power out to the neighborhood. Car came down on the back end, spilled out, tumbled. My father tumbles out of the thing. Cars totaled, power's out in the neighborhood. And my father did what I consider to be a very alcoholic thing. He surveyed the situation and went home. So the police, found the situation and figured out who it belonged to. And they came to our house in the middle of the night, knocked on the door to find my bloody, bruised up, drunken father. And the police officer, I'm told, said, Dr. F, you realize we're going to have to give you a citation for this. And my father said, I wasn't aware they gave awards for this sort of thing. And apparently that was when they decided to take him off to jail. So those are my people. That's where I come from. And I couldn't wait to get started. I absolutely remember the first time that I got drunk. Me and three other boys in the neighborhood, we were told by the older fellows in the neighborhood that if you drink a shot of beer every minute, you'll get really drunk and you won't get sick. And we thought that would be a good planned program of action. So we took a 12-pack of beer, four boys. I'm the youngest. I'm like 12. And we went in and we got a little digital clock. Digital clocks were actually mechanical blocks, you know, that just turned and made a little mechanical noise. These hadn't even advanced to the point where they flipped, you know. They were just a block. So we sat in, it was just an old tool shed that we'd painted psychedelic, and we called it our fort. And so we're sitting in there smoking cherry cigars, and we got these 12 beers and a shot glass, and just took the shots of beers and waited for the minute to spin around again, smoking cherry cigars. I remember thinking that these four beers are not going to get me drunk. Now, I've never been drunk in my life, but intuitively I'm concerned about the supply. And then there we are. And we persevered with our little one-minute shot of program, and I got those four beers into my 12-year-old body, and alcohol did for me what I believe it does for people like me. I was suddenly rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence. I was in the presence of my brothers. Everything was hilarious. You know, if somebody had kicked in the door of that tool shed with a shotgun, I believe I'd have stuck my chest out. Said, is that all you got, two barrels? You know, alcohol made me 10 feet tall and bulletproof, drastically handsome, able to sing. You know, it was wonderful. I loved it. It was a spiritual experience. You know, I hear people talk about that. I relate to it. We like to read the promises after every meeting, and that's absolutely what alcohol did for me. When I took a drink of alcohol, there's only like three shirts that I have after the holidays that I can button at the collar. Black wasn't my first choice, but it was the only one that would actually button at the collar. New Year's, I'll go on a diet again. So I take a drink of alcohol, I know a new freedom and a new happiness. And take another drink of alcohol, I no longer regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. And take another drink of alcohol, intuitively I can see how my experience, strength, and hope can benefit you, you know. I mean, it does something for me that I cannot do for myself. And I just assume that everybody has that reaction to alcohol. I just assume that. But I'm told that that's a 1 out of 10 reaction to alcohol. I don't know. Don't quote me on that statistic. But as I look back, in my 8th grade class, there was about 30 guys, and there were two other guys that were interested in not going to that class and heading with me out to the woods and doing what we wanted to do, which was, you know, drink those beers that we got that day. So I start finding those people. Those people become my friends. If you and I go out on a Friday night and you ever try to get drunk with people that aren't alcoholics, it's frustrating. They drink really slow. They put their hand over the glass and say, no, thanks, I've had enough. And they don't understand that I'm just trying to finish this pitcher off so that I can get another pitcher so that we can continue to do what we wanted. And they're fine. They don't need it. Excuse me, I got a tickle. So I only want to, you know, so if we go out on a Friday night and you drink like that, then we're not going out again. You know? I want to go out with Randall, you know, who's somebody who says, you know, after we close this place, we go back to my place, I got a jug and my roommate's got some outside issues and we'll make a night of it, you know. People who aren't alcoholics, they have big days tomorrow, you know? No, I got a big day tomorrow. I got a big night on tonight. That's what I'm interested in. Big night. So those people become my friends. I become friends with the 1 out of 10ers, the other alcoholics, people that like to drink like me. And that's all normal to me. That's what I want to do. I started missing opportunities early in life. I dropped out of high school, essentially. And spend my... Yeah. I essentially dropped out of high school. I had every opportunity. I could have gone to any college. I could have done just about anything. But I just started floating through life, and I just basically lived. I really liked what alcohol did for me. I looked forward to it. There was a time when it was exhilarating. It was, you know, I mean, it was enough. I didn't have to drink every day. It was enough to know that we were going to do something on Friday, or there was going to leak into the weekend. So I ended up dropping out of high school, and then I'm up against the idea that I don't want to live this way. I'm not this guy. I want to be better. I want to do better. So I quit drinking in high school. I stopped drinking on a dare. It was the first time I remember trying to control my drinking. See, I've got that thing that the book talks about. I got that great obsession that somehow, someday, I'm going to control and enjoy my drinking. You know, that somehow I'm going to find the right chemical combination or days of the week or the right brand, the right environment, and I'm going to be able to pull it off successfully, which I never really did fully define the terms of success. I think that just means, you know, not having anything bad happen or having a hangover. Thank you very much. Absolutely. That's very considerate of you. So I stopped, and I found out I could make it to class. I ended up finishing honor roll, but I'm just kind of plodding through life. I'm pretty good at starting stuff, so I started to go to college, and after about 120 days, the wheels come off. I'm good for about 100 days. I'm sorry. So I start off honor roll, you know, and then eventually my GPA doesn't keep up with my blood alcohol level. So I bounce back and forth between work and going to school. By the time I'm 19 years old, I've been to the funerals of four of my friends, the other one out of tenors. None of their death certificates say untreated alcoholism. They say stuff like car accidents, gun accidents, motorcycle accidents, and suicide. But those were my friends, not people I was acquainted with. Those were the guys I was hanging out with. All this stuff is normal to me. I knew that there was going to be a price to be paid for drinking. I knew that I was going to be sick. I knew that bones were going to break, fenders were going to bend, maybe some stitches involved. Maybe somebody's going to die. That's just the way it is. But what I get out of it, I've heard a guy say that alcohol used to, in the beginning, it did a lot for me and didn't do too much to me, but that we've got a progressive disease that over any considerable period of time, it does less and less for me, starts doing more and more to me. I experience that. So I go to the funerals of my friends. I'm thinking, alcohol doesn't make me 10 feet tall and bulletproof anymore. It still did enough for me that I was attracted to it. Again, I'm just plodding through life. I came back. I grew up not far from here, in Arlington, and my one and only geographic was down in Norfolk, Virginia. I'm going to go back to college one more time. So I got into ODU. I had some friends down there. Moved down to Norfolk, Virginia. Once again, stayed on a roll for about three semesters, and then eventually they asked me to leave. You don't seem to be taking this seriously. I'm like, I'm not. My buddy said, if you asked him what he majored in college, he said, I majored in the Grateful Dead. And I used to run around with him. So that band followed me all over the country for about 15 years. So I'm just kind of plodding through life, but I'm not getting as much out of it as I used to get out of it, and strange things are starting to happen. Strange and unpredictable things, sometimes violent. I got a big mouth. I'll shoot it off to the wrong person. I was convinced my last words on the planet were going to be, I was just kidding. Face mashed in the hood of a car. I remember coming to in the parking lot of Mixed Pancake House in Ocean View, 3 o'clock in the morning, in the fetal position, and I was thinking, this guy's going to get tired of kicking me in the ribs soon. He's going to wait him out. So that's my strategy. This is how I'm getting along in life. I don't know anything about alcoholism. I don't know anything about treatment. I don't know anything. Some celebrities are going away to rehabs and stuff. My sister, right about this time, my sister checked into a rehab in Arlington. And I remember going to visit her. And I got on the elevator and I went up to what appeared to be a very pleasant environment. I mean, it was there was a television on, and people were nice, and she was absolutely swacked on Valium, just high as a kite and laughing and rolling, having a good time. And I remember getting a glimpse of treatment and thinking, this looks like a pretty good gig. You know, television and benzodiazepines, and I could use a 28-day vacation. And but that just seed got planted in my head. I used to sit in this, drugs are part of my story. I don't say that to offend anybody. I don't consider myself a drug addict. I see myself as an alcoholic who's just up for it. You know, my drug of choice is, what do you got laying around? I never got a narcotics habit. I like the stuff that makes you go fast. You know, you don't want to spend all day cultivating an alcohol buzz and ruin it by taking a nap. So I go on these binges. Part of controlling and enjoying my drinking was because by now I got to have a job, so I got to show up there Monday through Friday in some condition, in enough condition at least to make it. But I would live for the weekend, and then just light it off on Friday afternoon and not draw another sober breath until Monday morning. And then I went to detox every Monday morning in my office, and just be mad at the world. So this pattern of going on binges, I guess you call me a binge drinker, I don't know. There were periods where my binges lasted for months, or maintenance drinking, or whatever you want to call that. 16, 18 beers a night is maintenance drinking, I don't know. But when I got time in front of me and no place to be, I liked being awake and drunk. And so that's what I strive for. And back in the 80s, when all this is coming down and you're the only person awake at 5 o'clock in the morning, there's only three channels on television. You just got to kind of take what they offer you, which ain't much. Not this like 200 channel surfing deal you got today with these kids. But I would see these commercials for Serenity Lodge, and I still see the guy. He's dressed kind of like Billy, good-looking guy, sitting on the front porch of this house, you know, and he says, I lost my home, I lost my family, I lost my job, but thank God I still have my health. And the voice announcer guy comes on and says, last year, Bob started a whole new life at Serenity Lodge. And I was sitting there thinking, that's what I'm talking about, a whole new life. And they're giving them away at Serenity Lodge. So I'd write down the number and hide it from myself. I'm making deals in my own mind, you know, like I don't know about you, but where in the circles that I grew up in, it's better to die than to be uncool, you know. Like, it's really uncool to have a tickle and not be able to talk. But so it'd be better to die cool than to live uncool, you know. And I know that it's not cool to call people at 3 o'clock in the morning and go, I can't make it. So I'd write down the number and I think, if I still feel this way tomorrow, I'll call. So I would always be able to muster up some new deal, new plan of attack. It's like, oh, good. I'm glad I didn't surrender last night, you know. I'll just leave this chemical alone. I'll just stay with Budweiser. Tequila's obviously a problem, you know, just beer. And just on Fridays, I'd just be able to muster some new deal, and I'd go off into the day with that new deal, new plan. But I always end up where I always end up every time. Well, one morning I woke up and I still felt that way. I still need help. I can't do this anymore. The things that I'm capable of saying and doing under the influence of alcohol are no longer particularly cute. I'm not going to do a fifth step from the podium, but I was capable of violence and I don't know, sometimes just plain weird old disgusting stuff too. Just stuff that makes me cringe to think about today. But it's not cute. It's not sustainable, and I don't see myself that way. I'm not that guy. I don't do that. I don't live that way. I don't believe in those things. So I called the number. I need help. And I swear to you, I'm embarrassed to tell you I'm so ignorant and arrogant at the same time. I don't know how those two things run on me so strongly, but I'm so ignorant about so many things, and yet I'm so arrogant at the same time. And I really kind of thought that maybe they would have heard of me, you know? You know, maybe send a limo or a helicopter or something. Yeah, you're legendary. We've been waiting for you, you know. I'm living in a little apartment no bigger than, you know, this section right here, and I think I'm famous somehow. Anyway, they hadn't heard of me, and they just wanted to know what kind of insurance I had, and I didn't have any insurance. So I thought, well, that's not good. I want to be like Bob. I want to be sitting on the front porch, you know, getting my life back, you know, and they're not giving me that. I went to the emergency room one night and said, I need help. I need you to, you know, take me off the street. I'm dying out here. And I kind of thought they'd whisk me up the stairs to the 8th floor and put me on the Valium and the TV would be up there. They didn't do any of that. They just waited until my blood pressure came down, sent me out in the street with a little piece of paper that had the Norfolk Inebria Program written on it. It was a little 72-hour detox facility. It was really just three hots and a cot. And they come by and they check your blood pressure, make sure you weren't going to stroke out. And if you needed to go to the hospital, they'd take you to the hospital, but it wasn't a medical facility. And mostly it was just street drunks. Coming in out of the cold, really, from what I could tell. But this, I don't know anything. But this is where I met you guys. I called that number, and I said, I need help. He said, can you get here? And I said, yeah, I can get there. He said, do you have a toothbrush? And I was kind of offended by the question. Yeah, I have a toothbrush. He said, well, get your toothbrush and come here. So I went there. I'm 22 years old. I've been up for 3 or 4 days straight. My arms are black and blue from intravenous drug use. I'm incoherent. I'm hostile. I don't really want to talk to anybody. I don't know what I'm in for. And then this guy starts 12-stepping me. This guy says, you ever thought about going to Alcoholics Anonymous? Now, I'm in the condition that I just described to you. And I'm like, no. I'm 22 years old. I'm dying. My skin is bad. I'm absolutely dying. And I said, no, I've never considered Alcoholics Anonymous. That's some kind of a religious thing. And I'm not a religious guy. And he said, well, you can make anything your higher power. You can make that doorknob over there your higher power. And I swear to you, I remember thinking, now I've just come from where I've come from. I'm absolutely insane. And I had the clear thought, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. They're worshiping doorknobs and Alcoholics Anonymous. So I show up and I meet you guys. I go to my first AA meeting, and it is not the attractive group of people that I see looking back at me right now. I'm 22. I wish I had a video of what it actually looked like, but I'll tell you what the way I remember it, it looked like God's waiting room. It looked like some sort of twisted purgatory. The median age in the room was like 157 years old. Some of them were on oxygen. All of them were smoking, you know.
If you want what we have.
I was like, no, I don't. I'm kind of hoping it's not contagious. I'll take my chances out there. But they told me three things at that meeting. They said, David, if you're an alcoholic, you got a body that's different than other people. You got a body that once you put any alcohol in it whatsoever, a craving develops that will never be satisfied. I never heard that before. I just thought it'd be a good idea to have another drink. But I never had a drink in my life that didn't want to have another drink. I've never had a drink of alcohol that didn't want to have another drink of alcohol. And I just assumed, like I said, I assumed everybody had that reaction. But reality is I look around, not everybody, you know, like the people who are frustrating to drink with. Like I look at my wife. My wife really enjoys the effect of one glass of wine occasionally. I mean, she relaxes, she becomes more animated, frankly, a little more fun to be around. People usually laugh at that. But she doesn't want the second one. Or if she has the second one, it becomes unpleasant to her. She starts to kind of get a prickly, hot, out-of-control feeling that she doesn't like. Do you think I'm going to be okay, honey? I'm like, yeah, you're going to be fine, baby. All I can tell you is I've never reacted that way to alcohol. I drink. Once I start, I don't stop. And then the second thing that they told me in that one meeting was that I'm carrying around a brain that's going to talk me into the first drink. You guys made a big deal out of the first drink. I thought, what is the big deal with the first drink? Stay away from the first drink. I'm like, it's clearly the 15th or 16th where things get problematic. You know, can't I just hold inside the threshold, you know? But it doesn't even dawn on me that if I don't take the first drink, then 15, 16 is not in the picture. But that's a physical thing. Once I start, I'm going to roll. And then I'm carrying around a brain that's going to talk me into the first one. And it doesn't sound like, David, you've got an obsession of the mind that demands that you take another drink. It's going to sound like, I deserve it. It'll be different this time. I've been a good boy. That's one of mine. I'm a good boy. I've been bringing the money home to mama and everything. What's wrong with a couple of beers with the boys on Friday night? I deserve that. And off I go. And then I'm on a run. And the third thing that they told me that I did not believe was that there was nothing I could do about it myself. That was my introduction to the idea of being powerless. You can't solve the problem on your own, David. Well, I'm one of the people who said, thanks for the information. And I left. And I didn't touch a drop for a year. I didn't drink. I didn't do any funny tablets. Didn't roll any funny cigarettes. Nothing. Bone dry. And if you've ever done that, if you're an alcoholic without a drink and without a solution, you know how absolutely untenable and irritating and horrible that is. I mean, if you'd have walked up to me during that time and go, how you doing, David? I'm not drinking. Well, how you doing? I just told you I'm not drinking. Because what I really want to do is get ripped out of the frame, falling down, hammered drunk. I'm not interested in getting tipsy. I'm not interested in catching a buzz. I'm not interested in a warm glow. I like getting ripped out of the frame, falling down, regrettably puking, hammered drunk. That's drinking. And I want to drink with people that drink like that. And that's the way I want to drink. So I'm not doing that. And I'm hating everything about me. I'm hating everything about you. That's the thing about untreated alcoholism, is it manifests itself in me. I don't like you very much at all, and I despise me. And that's a hell of a way to go through life. No wonder I need anesthesia. So this poor woman that I'm living with, she can't walk across the room without me having something to say about it. You know, how come you got to walk like that? You got an attitude? You think you're better than me? I thought, I'm an intelligent guy. My mind needs to be occupied. I should have a hobby. So I got a $9.99 aquarium starter kit, and I started keeping fish, read everything you can possibly read about keeping fish. I turned this little apartment that I just described into a tropical paradise. Three or four tanks in excess of 55 gallons each. I had little plant projects and little breeder tanks breeding little fish to feed to the bigger fish. You can't go near any of it because you might give it a disease. This is how I'm living, but I'm going to work, and I'm not drinking. Well, you know what happens. You know, clock's just ticking. She's going out of town for the week, and the thought comes to me out of the blue. Oh, she's going out of town. I know what I can do. And as soon as I had that thought, I couldn't wait for her to go. Could not wait for her to go. You know, like, honey, your parents miss you, you know. She's like, it's Tuesday. I'm leaving Friday. So off I go, and I'll tell you, up until that point in my little career, I'd been hospitalized, or I'd been to the hospital for stitches, broken bones, you know, bent fenders, things like that. You know, I'd never been hospitalized for alcohol poisoning, for instance. But that one night, after 1 year of not drinking, day one, I was in the hospital that night. Toxic. I wish I could tell you that I woke up, this had to be stopped the next day, but that marked the next 5 years of coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. In and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not believe that I was bodily, mentally different, and I did not believe that it was nothing I could do about it myself. I wouldn't believe it. So I don't want your phone number. I don't need a sponsor. I don't even know what a home group is. I'm not interested. But I kept coming around. I kept coming around. When I say coming around, I don't mean I came here, got a sponsor, joined a home group, worked steps. I mean I came in the back door, sat by the back door. If it was an 8 o'clock meeting, I came in at 8:05, and then I left before the chips or the prayer or whatever weird stuff you were going to do after that. I just thought maybe I could hear something, you know, that would serve me, that would be useful to me. So that's what I mean when I say I came in and out of AA. But I had no more than a year, but I had 6 months over there. I put together 90 days over there, a week over there, a couple hours over here, a new plan. I could always come up with a new plan. I got my one and only DUI in Fairfax, Virginia. In the my last year of drinking, I'll just tell you this. I had quit for a period of time, and I was heading down to Florida. I was heading down to Florida to go fishing with my two greatest drinking buddies, my brother and my father. And I was going to go down there, and my plan was to go down there and show them what it's like to not drink. Show them how to have a good time. Show them that you can go fishing and not drink, and you can enjoy yourself. And that was my plan. That was my thought. That was my will. And I got on the plane in Charlotte, and my brother had booked a connecting seat next to me in Charlotte without telling me. So when I sat down on the plane in Charlotte, there was a double jack sitting there that my brother had procured for me. Well, I don't want to be rude. So I drank that. Had a perfectly lovely time with my brother and my father over the next few days. On the way back from Florida, I needed that double jack. I was shaking. and I was hungover, and I was sick, and I was hopeless and despaired, and I needed that drink. And I remember drinking that drink on the plane on the way back, and I remember thinking, I'm not going to try to stop drinking anymore. I'm done trying to stop drinking. I'm going to stay drunk the rest of my life. And if that's 5 days or 50 years, I don't care. But I am not going to draw a sober breath. It's too hard. And I'm not as tough as some people. I made it about 3 months. They locked me up in Fairfax. And as I stood out in front of the law office of my grandfather, right there in Old Town Fairfax, and he was like the 17th registered attorney in the city of Fairfax. I never knew him. He died when I was about 5. But all my life, people had shown up in front of me and told me stories about my grandfather, kindnesses that he had levied on them. He had gone out of his way to do this for me, and he helped my son when he was in trouble. And I just loved your grandfather, and I was just standing there out of jail on that cold February morning trying to hold down the cold sausage and warm orange juice they'd given me and maybe get a cigarette in me, you know, and just thinking, God, you know, what have I done with my life? There was a man who did something with his life. You know, he was value to people. And what have I done? I haven't done anything. I haven't done anything worthwhile. I'm going to be dead before I'm 30. This has got to stop. This has just got to stop. And I wish I could tell you that I had one morning like that. I had 1,000 mornings like that. And then as I'm standing there trying to reconcile all that in my head, my cousin rolled up and he said, hop in. I know where we can get Budweiser for breakfast. And I thought, thank God you're here. I was thinking about quitting drinking. I was drunk by noon. Started going back to AA. Again, not because I wanted to get sober or wanted what you guys had, but I thought it would look good for court. And then I tried to explain that to my first sponsor, and he said it wasn't going to do any good. So that just was evidence to me that he was ignorant. Because obviously it was a good plan. It was my plan. I don't know about y'all, but I'm only interested in... I'm the only counsel I ever really seek. So these guys showed me AA, though. I stepped into, accidentally just stepped into this active group. It was a group of people. They were in action. They had their home group on Thursday night, and the men had a meeting on Monday night, and the women also had a meeting in another place on Tuesday night. All of that whole home group would mobilize around, and they would go to different meetings, kind of take over the group conscience. If somebody in the home group had something that needed to be done on Saturday, like moving or painting or something, the whole home group would show up and start doing it. I just went along. This is my kind of introduction day. I paint the fence, okay. This is AA. So I went. I ran with those guys. I'm 28 years old. I healed up pretty quick, pinked up pretty quick. My mind starts working again pretty quick. Dangerous, you know, for us. Start thinking. And I stayed with those guys long enough for somebody to insult me and hurt my feelings, you know. And so then I took my ball and went home. I'm not going to AA anymore. I'll do this my way. And I lasted 6 months in that environment. Never did take another drink. But I'll tell you what that looked like. I ended up 6 months abstinent of alcohol again. No drink, no solution, no recovery. And I'm just as angry and bitter and just the same guy who was a few years before. Only now everybody's gone. You know, there's no girlfriend to criticize. You know, it's just me. I got a job. That's all I got. So I ran all that through my little computer in my head, and I can't. So now I've gotten to that jumping off place, literally, where I can't stand to drink and I can't stand not to drink. Can't stand it. Either way, it sucks. It's just terrible. So I said, you know what? Suicide. That'd be the solution here. Let's just end it. I never thought about suicide when I was drinking. Homicide. Not suicide. Sober, I think about suicide. I'm just tired. I'm tired of living this way. So I'm driving around the city of Norfolk looking for buildings to jump off of. And when you're selecting buildings to jump off of, you have to be discerning, you know. I mean, if it's too short, it might not do the job, you know. And you might end up not being able to bend your arm up to your mouth, you know. Be like the Tin Man or something. Oil me. That'd be awful. And if it's too high, I'd have to spend a significant amount of time, you know, regretting my decision. I might be uncomfortable. I can't stand to be uncomfortable. These are the things that I'm thinking of. These are my meditations. And something in me just said, why don't you just go back to AA? Go to one more dumb, stupid AA meeting. But not that crazy group. Not those other people that insulted you and hurt your feelings. So by this time, I now know how to get to an AA meeting, and I go find an AA meeting, and I roll up to the place, and now I know to come early, too. They taught me to go early to an AA meeting. You know, if it's an 8 o'clock meeting, 20 minutes early, that's on time for you, David. It's like, that doesn't make any sense. Just come along. So I know to go early, and I show up. And I still, and you, we all know what an AA meeting looks like. You know, people standing outside with styrofoam cups, and they're gesturing and smoking, and they seem animated and pleasant. It's disgusting, isn't it? For a guy like me. And I roll up, and I'm in the suicidal condition. I roll up, and I see the AA meeting, and I get out of the car, and I can still see to this day, I still see that guy see me coming, which I do not like, because I now know I have to talk to him. And I don't like talking to people. I want to be cool. I want to slide in the back and slide out. Anyway, that guy stuck his hand out to me. Hi, my name is Walt. Hi, Walt, I'm David. Welcome, David. He patted me on the shoulder and he said, everything's going to be all right. I must have looked like somebody who needed a little reassurance. And at the same time, I was happy to be reassured, and yet I was offended because I thought, how do you know I'm not here to teach this class? This is what came here for you guys to work with. Ignorant and arrogant at the same time. But I make a big deal out of making that point because I can tell you that that man took the time to welcome me, and he brought me in and he showed me where the coffee was. And he took me to a seat and he sat me down. And he patted me on the shoulder again and he said, don't worry, nobody's going to call on you. And I thought, are you a wizard? How do you know that that's my greatest fear? That speaking in public is like talking in front of a group of people. I'm petrified of that. How does he know? But all I know is that guy took the time to make me feel comfortable in the rooms. I don't know if he's worked a step. I don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous or but he took the time to welcome me and make me feel comfortable. And I know that I sat in the chairs that night. I don't know how many dozens or hundreds of meetings I'd been to before that, but I remember that night sitting in that metal chair, and I remember thinking, I'm going to do what these people do. I'm out of answers. I'm going to get a sponsor, whatever that is, and get a home group and do these steps. Whatever it is, I'm going to do what these people do. I think to sell it to myself, I had to say for a year. You know? For 1 year. Mm-hmm. Until I can come up with a better plan. Mm-hmm. You know? And all I can tell you, I don't know if that was a spiritual experience. Because I have not had a sincere desire to take a drink since that moment. I've had thoughts of it. You know, things like that. But not a sincere plan to have a drink since that moment. But I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I did get a sponsor. I did join a home group. I started saying yes, like we were talking about in the beginning. Yes. Will you be the intergroup rep, David? Sure. What is that? We don't know either. Just go find out. I just started doing it. Started working the steps with a sponsor. I get up to that God thing, and I'm like, I'm an atheist. I'm not an agnostic. I have no respect for agnostics. I really believe you should take a position on these things. I had taken my position. I got thousands of hours on bar stools talking about the non-existence of God. Not ready to give that up. None of you guys would argue with me. Everybody was like, it's cool, David. You can believe whatever you want. It's for you to sort out. Really? Yeah. And I never met an alcoholic that didn't enjoy his own conception of anything. So they asked me one thing, though. They said, could you stop saying no and start saying maybe? Could you just move it into the maybe? Could you open your mind up that much to say maybe? And I don't even think I could admit it in front of them, you know? But I, like at a traffic light all by myself in my own company, I'd be like, maybe. Maybe I don't know everything. But I started to pray. I started to get on my knees and pray because they told me to. Even when I didn't believe, and I felt silly. They were like little negotiations. I get on my knees and I go, God, if you're there, of course, if you're there, you know you're there. And if you're not there, don't I feel silly? You know, this was the kind of prayer life is how I started. But I was willing to do it. I was willing to say those prayers. I was willing to write that inventory. I was willing to write down my resentments. And I find out in my first inventory that I'm capable of hating you for the exact same thing I'm capable of doing to you. That was new information for me. I find out in my fear inventory, I share this because it was huge for me. I sat down and write down my fears. And I'm a guy, when I got here, I would tell you I'm not afraid of anything. My number one fear is a fear of being alone. And I don't mean alone like in my own company, because I'm a piddler, I'm a project, I have an engineering mind, I like building stuff, I'm kind of happy in my own company. But I mean alone like forsaken, like abandoned, like friendless, like no pity or love or compassion from any other human being. That kind of alone. Just soul alone. And I'm looking at that, I'm like, oh, I didn't know that about myself. Wonder what my number two fear is. People. I swear that just glowed at me. I was just like, oh my God, I'm afraid of being alone. I'm afraid of people. No wonder I need, you know, assistance. That's untenable, you know? And there's all kinds of 180-degree fears in there that are out of phase, you know? I'm afraid of being broke. I'm petrified of hard work. I'm scared she's going to leave. I'm sort of scared she's going to stick around. You know, I'm scared. I'm scared to death. And fear is running everything in my life. You know? So you guys help me through all that. I get to the amends. I start knocking on the doors. I start paying people back. My relationships start healing. My father was a man I would have wished. I could have sat on a bar stool and convinced you that we need to drive to Florida and beat that old man up. You know, I hated him. I wished him dead. And we became friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the thing that I have to tell is that I have really found the only thing worse for my sobriety than calamity is prosperity. Calamity, I work a pretty strong program in calamity. Me and God are pretty tight. My sponsor's aware of me. It's when things start going good. And what happened to me, see, I don't have a great loss story. Because I've been drunk since I was 12 years old, I never accumulated anything worth having. So in Alcoholics Anonymous, stuff starts coming my way. You know, all I ever wanted was to be a husband. I wanted to have a family. I wanted to have a son, you know. I know you're not supposed to say that. I wanted a boy, you know, really. And then three of them came along. You know, I wanted to be a husband. Pretty little girl comes along, you know. She wants three kids. I want three kids. She likes chocolate ice cream. I like chocolate ice cream. It's God's will, right? A business drops in my lap. Not through my own entrepreneurship. Not through my own business acumen. None of that. It just showed up in front of me. And you guys gave me the courage to say, I'll try. I'll try that. So now I'm a husband. Now I'm a business owner. Now I'm a father. Now I'm a Cub Scout leader. Now I'm signing mortgages. I'm a citizen. You know, I'm a freaking citizen. I'm the block captain on the neighborhood watch program. The whole time that's happening, I start slowly leaking away from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I mean that. I started leaking away from Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't make a decision to leave. I didn't think I wasn't an alcoholic. I didn't think it would be a good idea to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. None of that happened. I had a sponsor die. I wasn't in a hurry to hire another one. Everybody at the home group's kind of a jerk anyway. Besides, I got all this going on, you know. And so I just, little by slowly, the gravitational pull, all that stuff, pulled me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, we'll fast forward to 15 years sober. I did everything I could for about 6 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I worked really hard. All that stuff came to me. For the next 6 years, I leaked away. Now I'm 14 years abstinent of alcohol, 14 years sober. I'm being invited to leave the marriage. My children are indifferent to my comings and goings. My business is failing. In short, I became the exact same person that we've already met. Hypercritical. Nothing's good enough. Nothing's quite right. You know, what's wrong, David? Nothing. Nothing's wrong. But it isn't quite right, is it? It's almost right. It's sort of getting near right. If I just issue a few more words of criticism, it might even get right. I got something to say. So, you know, what that got me was invited out of a marriage. And my children, I think, were happier when Daddy wasn't around. That's what 14 years of sober looked like for me. So, we got separated legally and physically. I moved out of the house. The closest thing I can tell you to a burning bush that I ever got was the back of a minivan at 3 o'clock in the morning searching for evidence to use in a court of law against this woman. So you know my serenity level is like really, really high. So I'm searching for evidence to use in a court of law against this woman, and I find a half-empty bottle of wine. And it glowed at me. And it didn't say, drink me, you'll feel better. Somehow the message got to me that you're an alcoholic. What are you doing? What are you doing? And I'd like to tell you that I went to AA the next day, but I went to Al-Anon. And they said, you're a drunk. Why don't you go to AA? All right. So I went to AA. I came back to AA. And I'm still, so I know what it's like to be, I mean, I know what it's like to be 14 years sober and dying of alcoholism. Suicidal. Again. See, if drinking was the problem, not drinking would be the solution. You know? We'd have a little two-step program. Put the plug in the jug and have a nice life. You know? That'd be it. AA, would we just change our Facebook status. Still sober. Good job. Like. You know? But that's... Drinking is a symptom of what's wrong with me. You know, I have a spiritual disease, right? I'm consumed with myself, selfish and self-centered. That's what you guys told me I was, that I didn't believe. I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. I don't know about any of y'all, but I'm gifted with the burden of insight. You know, I can see clearly where you're screwing up. And it would really be a favor to you if I told you. You got to live with me. It's a party. So there I am, 14 years sober and suicidal again. Go back to AA one more time. One more time. And you guys hadn't changed your story. It's like, well, you're going to get a sponsor and a home group. Start working the steps. Yeah. Well, it's the same deal as before. Okay, I'll do it. So I go interviewing a guy. Yeah, it's hard for a guy like me to interview another guy, select a sponsor, because I'm a special case, you know. But I'd cut this guy out of the herd, and I'd interviewed him, and I thought, he's going to be the guy. So we go to Starbucks, and I start giving him my tale of woe out there in front of Starbucks. He cut me off in the middle of my tale of woe, which I do not like. I want to finish my tale of woe. Very important. He cut me off, and he said, yeah, AA's full of guys like you. You're suffering from untreated alcoholism. I was insulted because I'm 14 years sober. This guy's like 8 years sober. You're suffering from untreated alcoholism. He said, you got to get a home group and work the steps. I said, I know. He goes, I know you know, but you're not doing it. Right, right. I asked him to be my sponsor. He said, yeah, I'll be your sponsor. But if I'm going to be your sponsor, we're going to move quickly through these steps. That's all I know sponsorship to be. I'm to help you with these steps, and we're going to move quickly through these steps so we can get on with the business of helping other people, because that's why we're here. And I'm embarrassed to tell you that that's when that penny dropped for me. That's why we're here. We're here to be helpful to other people. See, up until this point, AA was just here to keep David jolly. You're just here to make sure if I leave here and I feel better, that was a good meeting. Didn't occur to me I was supposed to bring something to it. Never occurred to me. You guys might have been telling me the whole way, but I didn't hear it. That's why we're here, love and service to others. And I got to tell you that since that penny has dropped, since that bell rung in me, I have not been able to unring it. And it's cleverly hidden on every single page of this book. Because after that moment, I went through this book with that man, and I went through this book with that thought in mind, and started doing the things that were talked about in here. But it's literally on every page of the book. To be helpful is our only aim. We simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted. Once we've overcome our difficulties, we're here to help others. So that has been the last 10 years for me, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. 12 years going on. That's the thing. That was a seminal moment. That rang my bell. I started doing the steps again, started recovering that ground, and started working with other people. And so today, I get to participate in a home group. I get to raise these children. The marriage reconciled. I always forget to clean that up. We're all living under the same roof. I think we're having a happy marriage. I'm happy. She seems to be. But I don't really know. I don't know. My kids are thriving. Business could do better. But I get to help other people too. I get to work with other men. I get to spend my time thinking about other people and not thinking about me so much. And I don't know. I don't think I'll ever live long enough to repay everything that Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. I am absolutely, by default, going to think about myself, concerned about myself, first. And what happens coming here and doing what we do, I end up being somebody who's concerned about you, interested in bringing something to the table rather than what I can take. Happy to give, not so concerned about what I receive. And I didn't know that that's where freedom comes from. I didn't know that that's where peace of mind comes from. And the desire to drink has gone. I'm not interested at all. Not even a little bit. And all I know is that I didn't decide that. I didn't engineer that. I didn't come up with that. And I had to be beaten into that state of reasonableness that they talk about. Isn't that funny that they beaten into a state of reasonableness, you know? Yeah, I mean, reasonableness is a relatively mundane condition, right? Reasonable. We all sort of expect everyone to be reasonable. But people like me need to be beaten into a state of reasonableness. Like, I can't solve this problem. I need help. What should I do? And thank God that AA puts track in front of my train that I can chug on and live a nice life with you. I think that's what I came to tell you.
Nice.
Thanks.